today. Alex, it's great to have you on our podcast.
Thanks, Lee.
And so today we're going to be discussing conscience rights and why those matter and all that kind of stuff. But first, can you introduce yourself and just explain to us a little bit more about the work that you do and that with Ethos Alliance?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So I work for an organisation called Ethos, and what we do is help people who are facing some kind of pressure because of their conscience or because of their most important beliefs. So for example, this might be an employee who's being discriminated against because of their faith, or a faith-based school who's being unfairly scrutinised by government agencies. And perhaps relevantly to today's topics, we hear from health professionals as well who are being asked to have some kind of involvement with a treatment or a procedure that goes against their conscience. And what we can do in those situations is provide people sometimes with support, with advice and advocacy directly. But we also work with a network of lawyers so that we can get people legal support and assistance when that's what we need. Ethos is set up as a charity. We're not a law firm, and that puts some limits around the support that we can provide ourselves. But that's why we work with a network of lawyers. Really just to help people to be able to fully live out their most important beliefs.
A bit more about yourself, like what's your background and what got you to where you are now?
Long story, but I used to be a lawyer, so I had a brief and pretty mundane career as a commercial litigator back in the day. And then I worked in public policy for a number of years. So it's really those two things kind of put together are actually sort of the foundation, the experience that I bring to the work that I do, which turns out to be pretty handy when you're thinking about things like, you know, draft bills before Parliament. It's the sort of pedantic analytical approach sometimes. Which
is that what a lawyer is, it?
Some of my best friends are lawyers, so, you know, no comment, but yeah. Yeah.
Right, so obviously we're talking about conscience and conscientious objection kind of rights today. Now, can you just tell us, like, as a non-legal, non-medical professional, why are these things important and why do we need them embedded in these laws?
Yeah, it's a great question because, even the word or the concept conscience is something quite abstract. It's not something you can, you know, sort of see or touch or say, you know, there's a conscience right there. So perhaps an easy way to think about conscience is that it's the beliefs that you have that give you identity, that give your life direction, that give you a sense of meaning. There's a theorist who writes about conscience whose work I think is really helpful, a guy called Xavier Simons, and he says that conscience is basically the disposition to find out what is right and to try and act accordingly. In the area of euthanasia, there was a significant case in the High Court a few years ago where they had to answer this question, you know, what does conscience mean in the End of Life Choice Act? And the court said it basically means personal moral reasons that are internal to the health professional who's thinking about euthanasia. And I think that definition captures it quite nicely because it's personal, so each of us has to make up our own minds about these issues, what do we think is appropriate to do, to be involved in or not. But the court also said that it's moral, which basically just means you're thinking about what is right and what is wrong. So there's a kind of a combination of a subjective approach, what do I think, and an objective approach, what is good, what is true, which is something that kind of stands external to us as individual people. And so, conscience is not like a free-for-all where we all get to just decide this is what I'm going to do and no one can tell me otherwise, because there has to be this this link to, you know, what is good for us, what is good for people. And that's something that we can discuss, we can reason about, we can debate. And I think it's really healthy and it's helpful when we do that. I think it's probably worth saying as well that, you know, because conscience is really important, it's recognised as a fundamental human right. No rights are absolute. Rights always have limits. But the really key concept here is that rights can only be limited for, you know, good reasons, compelling reasons. And that's, when we understand what conscience is and why it matters, it helps us then to work out, well, what would be good reasons? You know, where are the cases where we might limit it?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess in a HR kind of perspective, it's not like someone's just been like, I don't want to do that today. It's actually like there's a deeper foundation to those objections.
Yeah, and you know, when you think about the prospect of reasonable limits as well, you might, you know, you might ask, well, is this an objection that's coming from somebody's, you know, deep identity conferring beliefs, like their religious faith, or is it really just a you know, this will be inconvenient for me, or I just don't feel like it, sort of dressed up as conscience. If you're talking about an employment context, you know, you need to think as well about the fact that employers are paying you to do something. So, you know, another example that's often given is, you know, a classic case of like a conscience limitation is conscription. Mm-hmm. So if you say to somebody, you know, you are now going to, you have to do compulsory military service, that's obviously a significant limitation on people's freedom. And so you've got to have really good reasons for that. And those reasons tend to be, you know, significant threat to the nation, a time of war or something. But even then, you know, there's typically been exemptions from conscription for people with, you know, really deeply held pacifist beliefs, for example. So it's that kind of shows you how we recognize the importance of conscience. We recognize sometimes it's necessary to limit it, but we also say there are, you know, as much as possible, we're going to try and let people live consistently with what's most important to them.
Obviously, we're talking about some law changes in New Zealand. We've got euthanasia laws at the moment. There's a, I guess, a conscience right within that, embedded in that law. But now ACT MP Todd Stevenson has kind of drafted up a potential new bill. And so where does that kind of lead us?
Yeah, without getting into all the intricacies of how Parliament works, the bill, Todd Stevenson, who's a member of ACT, the bill that he's drafted is kind of sitting there as a proposed bill. It's not on Parliament's agenda yet. And because of the funny way that these things work, they're called members' bills. It may never see the light of day in Parliament, but also it could end up on Parliament's agenda next week. So you don't quite know.
Let's hope it doesn't.
you don't quite know what's going to happen. But that law does a number of things. One of the things that it would do is also expand eligibility for euthanasia quite significantly. So it would move it from just covering terminal illness likely to cause death in the next 6 months to a whole range of long-term conditions and disabilities. That's sort of probably the headline thing about the law. But in terms of conscience, it would basically bring in new limitations on individual health practitioners' conscience rights. And it would also put significant limitations on what are called care facilities, so places like hospice, rest homes, retirement villages, residential facilities for disability support, for example. So all of those places would have new obligations to basically to facilitate the provision of euthanasia and assisted suicide if this were to become law. And we've talked a bit about, you know, the importance of conscience sort of in a general sense. Another way to kind of think about that is there's a concept which is called moral distress, and what that really means is that if you are forced to do something which goes against the beliefs that kind of fundamentally constitute who you are, your sense of identity, then you're kind of tipped into this existential crisis. There's a really famous study that illustrates this, which was done in relation to nurses who had participated in elective abortions. From memory, there were about 10 nurses in the study. And most of these nurses had no kind of pro-life conviction against abortion. They were happy in general with the idea of abortion. But when they were asked about their experience of participating in these procedures, the kind of things they said, that the quotes that were recorded were really illuminating. They said things like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. You know, I wasn't squeamish about the blood, but I just couldn't believe that we were doing this. You know, I looked at the patient and I thought, I can't believe that this is possible for someone like her. And one of the things that's stayed with me about that study is that, in fact, out of these roughly 10 nurses, three of them had a tubal ligation, and the husband of a fourth had a vasectomy, because they basically said, I never want to find myself in a position where I might be tempted to choose abortion, given what I have just seen. So I think that sort of gives you a sense of what's at stake with these conscience issues, the sense that, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where you participate in something like this, you can no longer say, for example, I'm the kind of person that doesn't take innocent human life.
Mm.
And, you know, if you think about euthanasia as well as abortion, you know, obviously doctors, they begin their medical career by making an oath, swearing a vow that they will do no harm to their patients. So many doctors will say, you know, that's not why I got into medicine. And if I have to be involved in this, that's kind of contrary to the whole reason that I have chosen medicine as my profession. Mm-hmm. That's probably why when the Ministry of Health conducted a workforce survey, they asked doctors, you know, would you be willing to participate in assisted dying? And the majority of doctors said, no, I'm opposed in principle, and I would not participate in it. So I think that gives you a sense that there's something really important at stake here for doctors and for the medical profession as a whole.
Yeah, definitely. And as we're seeing in the research or in the stats, like for euthanasia, the number of doctors who are actually participating is also dropping. So it's not as though it's like more and more doctors like, actually, let's get involved. It's like it's quite the opposite. And in a study that came out last year from the University of Auckland that was, you know, conducted with like, what, 20 or something like that, doctors who were involved in it in the early stages. I mean, it also wasn't a super... It didn't sound glamorous from their side. Like, right. they weren't at ease. Most of them weren't at ease about, you know, participating in it. You know, they were like, oh, we don't sleep well the night before, you know, when it's assisted death and stuff like that. So it's like there's obviously something going on in their minds. And then there's also the others that are like, oh, the more euthanasias or assisted deaths that I, you know, help with, the more I feel like it was like kind of like fulfilling their purpose of life kind of thing.
Right,
I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
Concerning.
Yeah, well, you certainly see overseas, you get these doctors who have conducted, you know, in some cases hundreds of euthanasias. So, you know, that's an interesting scenario in itself. But yeah, certainly here in New Zealand, you've got not that many doctors are willing to participate. That's something the Ministry of Health commented on when they reviewed the current law. Mm. And I think that tells you something about the way that the majority of doctors see their purpose in medicine.
Which is good, like medicine is there for a good purpose. Mm. And what we're seeing is when the one hospice in New Zealand that decided to add euthanasia to their, you know, hospice, or allow euthanasias or assisted deaths on site, then a number of their nurses and stuff left because they just don't want to participate. Like, especially people who are in hospice care, they wanting to be involved in that support, I guess.
Yeah, well, hospice, as I understand it, is set up on this this kind of foundational belief that, you know, we are here to neither hasten nor prolong natural death. So the idea of kind of
not dying our national identity.
the idea of deliberately ending somebody's life prematurely is just contrary to the reason that hospice exists. Mm. And so the big question is, you know, if the law were to be changed in the way that Todd Stevenson's bill suggests, What happens to those institutions when you put them in this untenable position where they say, if we were to go along with this, we would be compromising the sort of the very reason that we exist? You know, again, that kind of poses an existential crisis for organisations who find themselves in that situation. And just to explain what the Stevenson Bill would do, would be to say that the care facilities, which is basically anywhere that somebody gets a temporary or a permanent resident, gets personal health services or care services, so things like assistance with showering, mobility, dressing, even substantial emotional support or disability support services. Any place like that would have to be prepared to allow euthanasia or assisted suicide on their premises, because if a resident asked for it, they would either have to say yes or they would have to ask the resident's permission to transfer somewhere else. And the resident might say no, or if their doctor says you can't transfer them, there'd be undue delay or suffering or so on if you did, then the assisted death would have to take place on the premises. So that's actually just a, as I say, sort of an existential challenge. Mm. And it's not just hospice. We're talking about disability support facilities, rest homes, retirement villages, you know, actually a whole range of institutions. So this has really wide-reaching ramifications.
And so doctors might feel like, you know, at the moment in the law they can object and they can kind of refer them to another organisation, whereas, do you want to just explain that kind of side of things as well?
Yeah, so the way the law works at the moment is that health practitioners, and that term basically means a wide range of people. So doctors, yes, but also nurses, psychiatrists, pharmacists, you know, they're the ones that actually dispense the lethal medication, for example. Mm. Health practitioners generally just have a right to say, you know, I have a conscientious objection to participating or assisting with euthanasia or assisted suicide. Unless they are what the law calls an attending medical practitioner, which basically just means the doctor who's caring for the patient. Now, if you're an attending medical practitioner, then if a patient asks you about assisted dying, and you have a conscientious objection, you have to tell them that you have that objection, and you have to tell them that they can contact something called the SCENS group, which stands for Support and Consultation for End of Life in New Zealand. And what that group does is it maintains a list of doctors who are willing to facilitate assisted dying. So at the moment, the obligation is on just a subset of doctors to provide that information. Some doctors will feel like that makes them complicit in a kind of a chain of causation, a series of events that leads to death. Other doctors might be okay with providing that kind of information and say, well, I'm not participating in it myself. You can actually get this information really easily just by Googling. So they might sort of say, well, patient's going to get the information anyway. Mm. Different doctors will actually come to different positions on that, and that's, you know, consistent with what we talked about before. Conscience is kind of personal and moral, so I think it's sort of a variation in views, you know, the law has to allow for that. But the proposed law change would sort of narrow that down and say there's fewer things that a health practitioner can object to participating in, which are much more closely linked to the actual, you know, direct facilitation of assisted dying. And what they would have to do is give the patient the contact details of the assisted dying service or contact the assisted dying service on their behalf. So it's trying to shorten the gap between patients asking and getting that information. I think it's helpful to sort of ask, you know, why that change? And the short answer is that basically the Ministry of Health sees conscience rights as an obstruction, as a barrier to patients, what they call health consumers, getting what they want. And at the bottom of all of this, I think, is a belief that the ability to choose, including being able to choose your own death, is kind of like a sacred right that you have. This is kind of fundamentally what constitutes being human. You get to choose these things, even to the extent that it might mean forcing somebody else to be complicit in your choice. And that's what the limitation of conscience rights impose.
I guess then for doctors, if they were involved in an incident or a, you know, situation where they didn't really know what to do, what would you suggest?
Yeah. Well, in a way, it doesn't help with exactly the question that you asked, but I think the best thing you can do is actually try and prepare yourself in advance. So think about these issues, and as I say, if the law change does pass, any health practitioner would potentially be faced with a situation where they have legally, they're required to provide, you know, this information. So you can role play with a colleague, you can try and work through what would you do if you were asked in that situation. Because I think it's easy for people kind of to freeze, to be uncertain of what the law actually requires of them. So for example, you know, the law might require you to go this far, but you don't have to go any further. It's good to know where the limits are in advance. And then if you're kind of unsure of the position, if you're sort of thinking, what am I going to do in this kind of situation? This is basically the reason that Ethos exists, is to help people with these kinds of questions. The earlier we know about the situation, the easier it is to help. Effectively. So one thing that health professionals can do is get in touch with us if they have questions about this.
Exactly. Would you recommend that people talk to their employer, like, before it even becomes an issue kind of thing, or just wait until a situation comes up, maybe, and like be prepared for that, but like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, what would you suggest?
Well, I think it'll be horses for courses, so it'll depend a bit on your employer, on the situation. So for example, if you're working in a public hospital, Health New Zealand has said that they are rolling out a new policy nationwide for assisted dying, and that will have that will address conscience rights for health professionals. It's going to be really interesting to see what that looks like, because I think the advice they are already giving hospitals and the advice that Health New Zealand is already giving health practitioners actually doesn't accurately reflect the law. So whether the new advice will be any better remains to be seen. But I think it's probably a good idea for doctors and other health practitioners in those environments to be thinking about these issues proactively and be trying to engage with the leadership of the hospital or the organisation as policies are being developed to make sure they accurately reflect the law and fully protect their rights.
Yeah, one of my friends who was a nurse, actually when she started, it was in a GP practice, and she didn't want to be involved in abortions or in some other things anyway. We won't go into it now, but she was just like, okay, I'm not going to be doing these for conscience, conscience matters. And I think it was like, because sometimes people come in for like weekly treatments and stuff like that, and she's like, I'm not going to be involved in those. And so I think like some of the other nurses were a little bit like, oh, it's kind of frustrating, you know, like you could be doing that kind of thing. But they also respected that, right, which is kind of good. So I guess, like you're saying, like it probably depends on the situation and where you're working and stuff like that, but maybe sometimes having those conversations can be beneficial as well. But I can imagine every area is really different, and you never know what's going to come up as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's probably worth saying as well that there are provisions in the End of Life Choice Act and in the law on abortion that say you can't be discriminated against because of your conscientious objection. I think it's always important to try and not just say, I have a right and I'm going to insist on it, but to kind of to try and engage with these things in a reasonable way. You can still be clear about what you will and won't do and firm in your position, but the more we can engage with people in a way where we're explaining our reasons, we're listening to each other, I think the better these conversations and the better the outcomes are going to be. And as I say, if you can do that earlier rather than when you're faced with a difficult situation and you've got to make a decision on the spot, that's going to be much better for everybody.
How can people access your services, if they are finding themselves in that kind of situation, how can they access your services?
The easiest way is just to go onto the website, which is ethosalliance.nz. And there's a simple contact form there, which asks for a little bit of introductory information that'll help us to understand what the question might be, any kind of significant details about it, like timeframes that we might need to know about. Click submit, and that'll come through to us, and we can take it from there. There's also a number of resources on the website looking at conscience issues in relation to a whole range of things, as well as euthanasia and abortion. There's all sorts of things that are there. And so that's a place where people can go just to start getting themselves equipped or resourced to understand the proposed law change, other kind of trends that are going on in this area as well.
It's really important, eh? And I guess to finish on a slightly lighter note, what things can we proactively be doing in the meantime, whether we're a medical professional or just a normal person in society that wants to make a difference?
Yeah. Not that medical professionals aren't normal people, I'm sure.
I mean, no, they're normal people. No, don't worry. I mean, I know plenty of medical, but you know what I mean? Like, sometimes we can feel like, well, that's not me. So like, I don't need to do anything about it. It's like, no, actually, I think all of us have an ability to speak into things, right?
Absolutely. So I think in general, if you see people who are putting their head above the parapet and actually engaging publicly with these kinds of issues, they need support. They need encouragement. It's a really hard thing to do. There's often blowback, and there can be costs that come with that kind of public representation or advocacy. Mm. So I think if you see that, it's really important to support those people. And there's a really human tendency, if you don't like what somebody's done, to offer a critique. People are probably quicker to offer negative comments than they are to offer positive comments. They might think something positive, but they keep it to themselves.
It's like, we like that you were pro-life, but you weren't pro-life enough, right?
Or just, oh, good on you for saying that, but you think it and you don't say it. Whereas if somebody says something you think is wrong, well, people often just, they'll say that quite quickly. So I think if you might know personally, or you might just see somebody who's engaging in these issues, drop them a line, tell them that you appreciate it, and let them know that you're supporting them. I think as well, in terms of the proposed change to the euthanasia law, it's worth saying that this is, it's only a proposal. It's not even on Parliament's agenda. It may never end up on Parliament's agenda. But on the other hand, it could be there next week. This is how members' bills work. So at this early stage, I think it's useful to engage with your local MP, whether that's your electorate MP or a list MP who's based in your electorate, just to speak to them. You know, they're going to have to make up their own minds how to vote. Perhaps slightly ironically, MPs get a conscience vote on these kinds of issues. So each MP has to individually decide, will I support this or won't I? And at this very early stage, before they've even had to engage with the substance of the issue, I think it can be really helpful to engage with them in a reasonable, a constructive way to say that if you have concerns, to say what they are. You could potentially even point them to resources that you think will help them. And just help them to start thinking through the issues as early as possible.
No, that's so important. Mm. And if you're going to be emailing your MP, then we would recommend writing a personal message to your MP, not just sending it blanket to like every single MP in Parliament, because it's probably not going to be read or not taken as literally anyway. So find who your local MP is or your list MP, and then send them an email. Keep it personal. Explain to them why you object or why you believe what you believe, and then send that to them. And also, you know, like, are these things impacting the way you're going to vote? Only be honest with that. But like, is it going to be impacting the way you vote in terms of what their beliefs are? Or else you could also ask them for a meeting with them to discuss it further as well. So some of those things are different ways that pro-lifers can get involved a little more politically, I guess, as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And you know, there's opportunities to kind of gather in your community groups, your church groups, whatever kind of circles you move in, and kind of connect with like-minded people to kind of talk about these issues and inform and equip each other as well.
Totally. Sharing like your guys' blog posts and stuff like that on their social media or ours as well. Like,
you know,
we've got a social media you know, thing that will be sharing different, you know, things that are changing or blog posts and stuff like that. And so, you know, that's can be a great way to kind of support these organisations as well, isn't it? That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming along today. We really appreciate it. And
thanks,
hopefully
Lydia.
Our audience has found it helpful and maybe you have learned something.
I hope so too. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Pulse podcast is brought to you by Voice for Life New Zealand. If you enjoyed this show and you think that having a strong pro-life voice in the public square is essential, then please support this podcast and all of the other important pro-life work that Voice for Life is engaged in at voiceforlife.org.nz/donate. That's voiceforlife.org.nz/donate. Link in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on The Pulse.